All right, ladies and gentlemen, Greg Kokel on Stand to Reason, your host today, as usual, Sundays 3 to 5, and I'm in a good mood today. I don't want to quite tell you why. All right, I'm going on vacation soon. That makes me feel good. I got 2 more hours of work, and then I'm off. Just got off the plane about 2 hours ago from St. Louis, talking there about the Da Vinci Code. And I want to start out talking about that a little bit with you, and then we can just take it anywhere you want to go. 1-800-227-5278 is my number here. And if you're in the 714 area code, that's right around the corner from where we're at. You can dial local 754-4150 and raise an issue, talk about the Da Vinci Code. If you saw the movie, I'm interested to hear what you have to say about it. But the rule, of course, always give me a piece of your mind. Now, we've been talking about this Da Vinci Code here for a while. The movie finally broke Friday morning, and the Stand to Reason staff was in line for the first showing in our neighborhood. Now, some people aren't going to see it, and they don't want to because they don't want to give their money. Of course, given the work that we do, we thought it's more important for us to be informed. And I'll tell you a little secret. Most of us were looking forward to it. We'd seen the trailers, and many of us had read the book, and we were – you know, looking forward to a good yarn. And I guess I'll just be right up front with you right now to spill the beans at the beginning. I really wasn't disappointed. In other words, I liked the movie. I enjoyed it. Now I'm talking here as a movie goer. Apparently this movie had the 13th biggest opening on a weekend in history and the number one biggest internationally. Because this is an international bestseller, so I'm not surprised internationally it had a big, big opening. And I guess I'm not entirely surprised that there was a big opening this weekend. We'll see what happens as the word gets out and people, you know, tell their friends whether they like the film or not. And we'll see what happens next weekend. I guess the reviews have not been coming in very good, but I enjoyed it, you know, and I'll give you my rundown in just a few minutes, and it's just going to be a brief one because it's a movie about a book we've already talked about. But I'll just make some reflections on the film from my perspective. But I have some other things to talk about relative to this issue. And last evening, I taught in St. Louis to a church audience, and which actually a lot of people from outside their church that came as well to on this particular issue. It was basically the material covered in our Solid Ground article entitled The Da Vinci Code Cracks. And you can get that, of course, it's at str.org. You can download it right from our homepage. It's free. And do they still have the cover letter, the Solid Ground cover letter? Is that there as well? Because that's an important letter that goes with it. So you get the Solid Ground, and then if you get it in the mail, there's a cover letter I send. That has more information about this. In fact, in that letter, I talk about how I did the analysis, the method I followed, and you can follow the same method in assessing anything else, not just things like this. So hopefully I'm teaching you some tricks in the process there. But download that and copy it and give it to your friends. And I mean, it's public domain as far as we're concerned. You can distribute that as, and make photocopies and get as many copies out as you'd like, or you can email it to friends. There's no limitations on that at all. I'll tell you one thing that I told the audience last night, though, and I've been mentioning this all week. I think I've done, in the last 7 days, I think I've done one TV thing that will be aired tomorrow on CBN. Is that right, Melinda? The CBN clip will be tomorrow sometime, the 700 Club. And it's a montage of different people were interviewed, and I'm included in that. I think you can go to our website and also see the film clip as well. Preview now on our website. Is that right? Okay. You can do that if you'd like. You know, many of you had heard me talk about this, so I don't know if there's anything new, but I'm offering some thoughts there that you might be interested in checking out. Anyway, so I had that on Monday, and then I had probably 6 or 7 other radio interviews, including one that happened right after I got out of the theater on Friday. In fact, I had to leave the movie about 5 minutes early, but I'd read the book. I knew what the ending was, and pretty much all the action was behind me, so I got in the car and hopped over to the studio, or rather to the office, and took the call, and for 45 minutes talked about what I'd just seen. But one point that I try to keep making here is I am so proud of the body of Christ by and large, and I'm using this term very broadly, not just Protestants, all those that from a Christian religious perspective who are responding to this issue, and almost without exception. The response has been sane and intelligent, and I think for that reason, powerful. I think the press is scraping around to try to find any examples of hysteria from Christians based on this, in response to this book or this movie, and they're having a hard time finding it. You know, they say if it bleeds, it leads, and if they're really looking for a story and it's not bleeding, they might work to try to draw some blood of their own. And this is why I've been frustrated. Given all the sane response, it seems like the press still finds those little corners of insanity that respond poorly in this case, and they're giving it press coverage. But in any event, by and large, I think there's been a sensational response. I understand if in the podcast world, those of you who know about that, you know, there are different categories of this podcast, and so we, for a while, were doing really well, and still are, in fact, but not right at the top of the religious and spiritual podcast group. Josh McDowell launched, was it yesterday, right to number two, not of the religious spiritual broadcast group, but right to number two of every broadcast in the whole system. And I'm virtually certain it's because he's been talking about this issue, the Da Vinci Code. And so my hat goes off to all the Christians who are working hard to make the case. And if you recall, a few weeks ago, I was talking about a chapter that Bill Dembski wrote in a book that was written in honor of Phil Johnson. And in that, I think it's called Darwin's Nemesis. And in Dembski's response, he gave us a real good tactical a bit of advice. And that was simply this. When you're engaged in an enterprise, and he just used, for example, soccer, just as an illustration. When you're engaged in an enterprise, let's say you're playing a sport, soccer, and the other team is cheating like crazy, and the referees aren't calling them on it. So you're getting no help from anybody. You're on your own. You have one of three choices. First, you could cheat back, or you could complain and whine and moan, or you could score. And that's exactly what Christians are doing in response to this issue. By and large, they're not complaining and whining. By and large, they're not cheating, answering in kind. They're scoring, and they're scoring big for those people who are listening, because this was an easy one, to be honest with you. It's too bad we had to deal with it in some sense, but in another sense, a lot of people are getting educated about what the truth is about history. And this is another point I want to underscore here, friends, and this is a very critical tactical point. When I left the theater yesterday, it was about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I went to the 10:15 or 10:30 showing, first one of the day in our area. And as we were leaving, there were Christians with crucifixes standing by the road with signs to be visible to those who were leaving the theater. It's pretty obvious. There were lots of them, in fact. And their sign said something to the effect of, quit trashing the deity of Christ. Now, this is really unfortunate. And I understand the emotional sentiments of those whose faith has been attacked, and how something very dear to us that is slighted in a very public way, the way Dan Brown has slighted Christianity, can be painful to those who are Christians and hold the name of Christ dear and worship Jesus as God. But I promise you something. The only influence that those signs made on anyone was to annoy them. Either they were disregarded or people got annoyed. And my question is, what is the point of doing that? You see, when we face these kinds of things, and we whine and complain because we don't like the way people are treating us, we lose. When we confront these things and we get angry and vicious and call for essentially book burnings and boycotts and those kinds of things, we lose. We do not win anyone. Nobody feels any better about this movie on the outside or about our cause. Now, we may feel better. Unfortunately, we may feel better, and my point is, without good cause. because we haven't done something good. We certainly haven't honored God by saying, quit trashing the deity of Christ, you pagans. Paul says, don't judge those outside of the church. They're doing just exactly what we expect them to do. Why should we expect anything different? Leave them alone in that way. Don't complain. Instead, score. And here is the tactical mistake that people who have done this have made. They have made this a battle between theology and culture. Theology and culture. You guys made a movie that disagrees with my theology. I'm offended. So what? Why should anyone care whether Christians are offended because somebody else has a different theology than they have? I said time and time again yesterday, last evening, and other times when I've talked about this issue on the air, the interviews that I gave this last week, this is not about theology. The case that I'm making, the issues I'm raising, the objections I have to the Da Vinci Code are the exact same questions, issues, challenges I would offer if I was an atheist. Because my argument is not a theological one. Mine is an historical one. I am objecting to Dan Brown because he didn't get it right. He made it up. He said he was speaking facts and he wasn't. It was nonsense. Now, I think he got taken in because he took for some of his research work that Michael Bagent of the prior book, Holy Blood, Holy Grail, had done. And I think Bagent was taken in by Pierre Plantard, who's now dead, but he's the guy who invented the idea of the Priory of Sion. No, it wasn't founded in 1099. As the frontispiece in Dan Brown's book says, under fact, it was founded in 1956 by a Frenchman, Pierre Plantard, and he falsified all these documents, the dossier secrets, or this, in, that were found there by Bagent and his buddies, and were the in a Paris library, and so they were taken advantage of. In that point, the Mary Magdalene stuff, the Priory of Sion stuff, but all the other stuff. The stuff that I'm concerned about, the things that I wrote about, his attack on the Bible, he should have known better, because a second-year theology student in grad school could have answered every one of those challenges. And if he went to Talbot, a first-year student could have done it. So there's no excuse for that kind of thing. My beef is with the facts, not with Dan Brown, who has a different theology than I do. The minute we make the beef about theology, people quit listening. We just sound annoyed because people don't believe what we believe. But if we make a point about the facts, well, let me put it this way. If we make it about theology, we win nothing. But if we make it about facts, then I think we can win everything in a certain sense. We accomplish not only by correcting the history, but Christianity and Christian theology, since it's grounded in the facts of history. We have then provided a legitimate platform for our theological claims to flourish. So it isn't as if I've abandoned Christianity in this enterprise and I just care about facts kind of in isolation. No, it's these facts that substantiate Christianity, but I'm not fighting about the theology. Let's fight about the history. Once we get the history clear, gosh darn, we've got a footing. Now we've got a place to fight from for the theology. But first things first. And so my whole critique is on the theology. And those folks who did the sign business, they were beefing. I'm sorry, my whole critique is on the history. And those folks who did the sign business were beefing about the theology. Big tactical mistake. All right, here's my analysis of the movie. I mentioned I liked it. And I'll just do this real quickly. With regards to the story is much more streamlined, obviously, for a film. And I'm not going to give away any secrets here. Not that there is a whole bunch of them, especially if you read the book. I talked to some people who saw the movie, didn't read the book, and they were a bit confused. The storyline was hard for them to follow. It was easy for me because I knew the story. I actually thought it was nicely compacted. And I thought that Ron Howard did a nice job, or whoever is responsible for the screenplay, of covering a lot of ground in a few short lines and images. It was pretty clever. I leaned over to Melinda a couple times. I said, oh, look how they did that. See how they covered all that ground that took pages and pages and pages in the book, and they did it with a line or two. Some of you wish that maybe Dan Brown would have done that. The book would have been so long. Or for some of you so tedious. But that was nicely done. The film work and all of that, the production value is first rate. The casting was sensational. I mean, I think they chose the cast really, really well. All the players were properly chosen. I think they fit their parts really well. I'm looking for the list of the names now. Well, how is it that things disappear from underneath my eyes? Here we go. I mean, I know these guys, but sometimes it takes me a second to download it, so I'd rather read it. Ian McKellen, of course, Sirley Teabing, the British royal historian. Many of you know him as Gandalf. Robert Langdon was played by Tom Hanks. He's the Harvard religious symbologist, French cryptologist. Sophie Neveu, played by Audrey Toto, to perfection. I mean, I cared about her character. I got emotionally involved in her travail through the movie. I was actually, there were a couple of scenes where I got a little choked up. And then Chief of Police Bazu Fash, Gene Reno, spot-on casting. Paul Bettany played the bad guy, Silas. And it was just great. The first 15 minutes, I was enthralled, entranced. It was like, oh, this is one of those movies that are just, it's just happening just right. Now, it didn't maintain that level of attraction, appeal, intensity for me, but it did still do pretty well. And so I liked the movie. Now, the questionable part, when you got to the scene with Sir Teabing, when he lays out his whole anti-Christian, anti-Bible historical nonsense, essentially, that was greatly reduced. And there were two particulars that I noticed in this. Not only were a lot of that dialogue left out, but, you know, Teabing sounded a little bit loony when he's making these claims. And the Robert Langdon character, played by Tom Hanks, actually played the devil's advocate. No, not even that. Devil's advocate means somebody who's playing the other side for the sake of playing the other side. He actually argued for our side on a couple of points, and he seemed to do it fairly convincingly. It's almost like one of our guys was there. Wait a minute, Lee. You know that the Christians believed in the deity of Christ long before the Council of Nicaea. Boom, 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 boom. Back and forth. Big argument. But he's making the case. So I think that had the effect of muting the more offensive historical theological factors that are in the book. Now, the book is still a big problem. It needs to be challenged. But for me, having read the book and then seeing the movie, I thought it was much muted. Those of you who haven't read the book and saw the movie, maybe you saw something different. I'll be glad to hear from you at 1-800-227-5278. So you can tell me your point of view on that one. But in any event, I thought it was sanitized compared to the book in that regard. And there was a couple of really stupid scenes. Really stupid. These were the flashbacks. One was a flashback to Nicaea. And so here are all these bishops yelling. 318 of them. Every single one of them yelling. I mean, it looked like Food Fight in Animal House or whatever that movie, you know. I expected them to start chanting, Toga, Toga, Toga. Oh, and by the way, they were wearing the tall hats called mitres and had all these kind of royal cardinal-type vestments on, the kind you'd see now people wearing. I guarantee you, I could be wrong on this. Maybe somebody else knows more about the history, but I'd be really surprised if the bishops in the beginning of the 4th century wore those things. That looked like 12th or 13th or 14th century vestments. They threw that in there. That was silly. And then there was the battle, this alleged wars between the pagans and the Christians. You know, where did the Christians get the army in the first 3 centuries? They were pacifists, for goodness sake. They weren't fighting anybody. They wouldn't even fight the people who were killing them, which is what was happening much of the time. In fact, even 20 years before Nicaea, you had the great Diocletian persecution. So that was crazy. And some of you noticed that right away. But other than those, I think it was fun. Now, if you want to tell me about it, fine. 1-800-227-5278. And in the 714 area code 754-4150. Time for a break. And when I come back, I'll hear from you right here on Stand to Reason.
Stand to Reason has an absolutely unique cruise conference experience for you this fall. Hi, I'm Greg Kokel, and on September 16th, we'll set sail from Boston with Holland American Cruise Line. We'll enjoy the scenery of the New England coastline, the Canadian Maritimes, the St. Lawrence Seaway, Quebec, and Montreal. In addition to the scenery, you'll enjoy the fellowship of other like-minded Christians and a conference program designed for those who want to represent Christ to a world looking for answers to life's toughest questions. And I'll be joined by some very distinguished guest speakers. Dr. J. Wesley Richards from the Acton Institute, national radio talk show host Kirby Anderson from Probe Ministries, and Kurt Swindoll of Cool Strategies, who will emcee all of our events. Our plan is to stimulate you with challenging presentations, answer your questions in open forum discussions, and enrich you through interaction and fellowship, all against the backdrop of New England and the Canadian Maritimes in the fall. Come join Stand to Reason and our all-star lineup for a memorable spiritual adventure. Space on board is limited, so get the details from 1-800-2-REASON or visit str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON or str.org. I look forward to seeing you on board.
The Apostle Paul knew well the effect on those who engaged in empty chatter as they spread the virus of false knowledge. They went astray. So while entrusting the treasure of truth to his disciple Timothy and encouraging him to entrust it to other faithful men, Paul also exhorted him to guard the treasure. Paul's word guard comes from the activity or office of a watchman whose job it is to protect those who are asleep from harm. It implies a deliberate, conscious act and demands discernment in knowing what it is that has been placed under our care. Guard the treasure was Paul's final message to Timothy before Paul's death. It reflected the heartbeat of his ministry. Stand to Reason has chosen it as our theme this year because it reflects the heartbeat of our ministry. Guard the treasure which has been entrusted to you. To learn more about Stand to Reason and how we are training Christian ambassadors to guard the treasure, visit us at www.str.org. Our website is full of unique and useful training materials to train you to be an effective ambassador for Christ. That's www.str.org.
Say goodbye to all my sorrows, and by tomorrow I'll be on my way.
And that'll be me on the jet heading for Wisconsin, ladies and gentlemen. Woo! No, it's not New York. It's Lac du Flambeau. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason, already getting warmed up for my vacation coming up here in the next couple weeks. Incidentally, next week we're going to have a replay of a show with Marv Meyer and Brett Kunkel, Brett being our Stand to Reason host, and Marv Meyer, of course, being the guest, the professor of ancient history. I'm sorry, Paul Meyer. Yeah, I wrote it down wrong. Paul Meyer, Marv Meyer is from Chapman University and a specialist in the Gnostic Gospels. Paul Meyer is not a fan of the Gnostics. He's the Christian. Thanks for the correction. See, I need a vacation, don't I? I need a break. Sorry, Marv, and sorry, Paul. Next week, Paul Meyer, professor of ancient history from Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. And this was a great interview a few months back. I think it was even in first part of the year, maybe in the fall. But in any event, he talked about the historical background of the early church and as it related to Da Vinci Code. So that's next week. So stay tuned for that. And I think the following week, Brett will be on live and do the show as well. And then I'll be back with you. An explanatory comment, because this issue has come up a couple of times. I think when I've talked about the movie, anticipating it coming out, I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, don't go to the movie right away. Don't give your vote for the movie the first week out. Wait a week or two and then go see it. If you want to talk with your friends about it, then you could say, I've seen it and I know about it, whatever. And then your ticket isn't going to count as a vote for the movie. And then on the very first day out, Mr. Kokel standing in line. Well, in my case, this is an atypical example, all right? Since I had to do a radio interview that afternoon about the movie, I needed to go see it. And in my role as a researcher and a public spokesperson regarding these issues, Melinda says, yeah, keep it from being the 12th biggest opening. Yeah, I didn't help much in that one. But the point is that some people are calling in, Kokel, that's inconsistent. Well, yeah, no, it's not, because the rules are different for the rank and file than they are for me in this one. If you have a compelling reason to see it early, then see it early. I did. But if you don't, then don't. See it later. Or don't see it at all. It's up to you. To the phones. And in Louisville. I said it right, Jeremy, didn't I? Louisville? Is that the way you guys say
Louisville.
It? Okay.
We'll say it here.
Yeah. Welcome to the show, Jeremy, in Louisville.
Hey, thanks a lot. I've been listening to you for a long time. I'm a big fan, Greg. I like what you guys are doing.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I had a real quick question here. Specifically, it has to deal with John chapter 8, verse 1 through 11.
Okay. That's the famous passage of the woman caught in adultery.
Yeah.
Jesus writes in the stand, it says that he was without sin cast the first stone.
Yeah, and basically from my research as far as this goes, it comes from the Western group of manuscripts, the Codex Bizet, is how you pronounce it?
You know, I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce that.
Okay.
Well, I have to see it.
Yeah.
Are you thinking of you're not thinking of the Byzantine text, are you?
No.
Because the Byzantine is Eastern, not Western.
Okay. Well, no, it's B-E-Z-A-E, the codex.
Okay. And, Beza.
Yeah, Beza, okay. And, I mean, as far as the research I've done is it comes from the Western group, this specific codex.
Yeah.
And it's about 5th or 6th century, they say it. And my question is, why does necessarily we include it in the Bible today when it, I mean, it has different vocabulary style and different, it's different from the rest of the gospel.
Okay, let me explain that. What we're talking about here, to bring other people up to speed, is even though when you look at all the manuscripts existing right now for the Bible, we have 5,366 portions of the Greek New Testament, we have 19,000 translated versions, like in the Coptic or the Syriac or the Latin Vulgate, we have 36,000 patristic quotations. We've got a lot of information to draw from. And so we can reassemble the Bible pretty with a high degree of confidence that what we have before us is what the original actually said. Now, there are still some question marks. It turns out none of the question marks affects anything really important, but if you have a Bible that is sensitive to these variations, the textual variation, you'll see marginal references in your Bible that indicates that a passage that you're reading maybe doesn't have a good attestation from the earliest documents. What happened is the earlier translations, let's say the King James. King James was based on Greek translations, but or rather Greek documents. But the Greek documents they had weren't as old as some of the Greek documents that were discovered later. And they were largely a Byzantine text type. And I can't go into a lot of details about that. I suspect you know what that means. But it's kind of a family. It's like a whole group of manuscripts that all read similar to each other because they probably all came from one core manuscript. So any ways that it diverges from, say, another text type, they all diverge in the same way. So they're a family. And we had a lot of Byzantine text type, tons of them. This is why it's called the majority text, because most of our examples of Greek texts are of this text type, principally because the Byzantine Empire didn't have as much persecution as the Roman Empire, and there wasn't as many you know, documents destroyed, and so they survived better. But they're older; they're like, you know, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th century. Okay, well then, when these earlier documents started to surface, it seemed like, well, the earlier ones would be more reliable. And a lot of them had, even though there were fewer of them, a lot of textual critics came to that conclusion. And so the newer translations, particularly New American Standard, is drawing on more this, and really any of the translations you have today, is drawing on this more recent scholarship and this much better and more grouping, I should say, of academic manuscripts, okay, Greek manuscripts. So since everybody's been reading these things for a long time in their King James Bible, and then they discover with the newer things that some of these things were left out of the earliest manuscripts. They still printed in the Bible, but they put a marginal rendering. And they say, well, this wasn't in the earliest manuscripts. And basically, you can make your own judgment on this.
Yeah.
The some things were changed, and in most New Testament, the King James has a section in 1 John chapter 5 that seems to speak very clearly of the deity of Christ or the Trinity. This seems to be obviously an interpolation that's something that was put in late. It's in the King James. It's been taken out of almost all the newer translations. Now, this offends King James-only people, but there's good evidence this wasn't in the original. And so those who are doing the Bibles nowadays don't put it in there because they don't think it's authentic. The passage that you just identified and the long ending of Mark, and in your Bibles, you'll see where that starts, about 8 verses there at the end of Mark. But these are two other famous places where it seems like, you know, there's been a little addition. Now, when I read John 8 and I read the long ending of Mark, I have two different responses to that, though. The long ending of Mark, it seems even to a person reading in English, this looks like it's written by somebody else.
Yeah.
It just has a different pace, tempo, whatever. It looks foreign in terms of the writing style. When I read John chapter 8, though, I understand that this passage is not attested too well in the earliest manuscripts, and therefore probably the best thing to do is to not treat it as canon. But it is such a clever passage, it actually reads to me, and maybe the Greek is a little different. You can tell me about this if you want, Jeremy, but it reads to me very smoothly or coherently through the passage. It sounds like it belongs there, and I'll tell you what else it sounds like. It sounds like Jesus. This sounds just like Jesus. It's in the character of Jesus. And so other people have noticed this too. I mean, it's just like Jesus to say, all right, let him who is without sin cast the first stone. I mean, they're playing a trick on him, right? They got the woman, not the man. They're trying to trap him.
Yeah.
What do? We stone this woman. She's guilty. What do you say? You know, and so what's he going to do? Well, he got himself out of it very cleverly. He says, the man without sin cast the first stone. And then he starts writing in the sand. Now, we don't know what he wrote, but one could conjecture that he's writing the names of some of the people standing around and their sins. You know, and that's why they all of a sudden, one by one, they start fading off until nobody's there. And then the second clever element about this passage is that people think, well, Jesus just forgave her, or he didn't take the sexual sin seriously, or some people even got from this passage that Jesus was unwilling to condemn consensual sex. And so the homosexual crowd really likes this passage, you know. See, Jesus was affirming sexuality. No, nothing of the sort. What he did was he asked a question. He said, is there anyone here to condemn you? And she said, no. And he said, well, then neither do I condemn you. How can Jesus condemn her? He was not a witness to the crime, and there are no witnesses to the crime, so he keeps the law. But he also foils this attempt by the Jews to, you know, pull this thing off. And so he accomplishes both goals, which is the kind of thing Jesus would do. And then he says, go and sin no more. So I think, you know, there are these clever aspects to this passage that just seem to ring true. Now, I don't think the ring of truth, as it were, overcomes the textual problems. And so I think some have conjectured that maybe this was an authentic story that was passed down through oral tradition,
yes,
but wasn't included in the Gospels, and somebody included it. Some scribe added it in the later manuscripts. Now, that probably would mean that those words are not inspired, but it doesn't mean that those events didn't happen.
And
I think those are some of the reasons why it's included. Partly it would look really weird after all the numbering's been done to knock out like 12 verses out of the text and have a big blank spot there and have the numbers jump. No, they include it because that's what people are used to traditionally reading, but then they put a warning in the margin.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's my take on it. What do you think, Jeremy?
Yeah, I agree with you. I was just curious about that. I wasn't sure how they exactly did they take them from basically all three groups, the Western, the you know, the
majority text.
Yeah, the Alexandrian and...
Yeah, there's... You probably know more about all that than I do, having done your own study. I forget that stuff easily, but it just depends. Sometimes they go with the majority. Sometimes they go with the oldest document. Sometimes an older document that has one thing and the majority has another thing, the majority text, which is more recent.
Yeah.
And you normally would think, gee, it's easier to – the older documents are probably more authentic or more reliable in terms of their accuracy. But sometimes you can actually see in the text, by looking at it, you can see what went wrong. You say, well, he just transposed these words. He picked up a phrase from two verses down and plugged it in, the scribe who is copying. He picked it up by accident. He's looking at the paper. He's looking at the letter. He's looking at the paper and the letter back and forth copying, and he just looked at the wrong phrase. We do that sometimes to ourselves. And so you can kind of figure out by looking at it what probably went wrong. And sometimes you would, if you see that in the older text, the more ancient text, and you see something different in the more recent text, then you'd probably think, well, you know, maybe the more recent text got it right. Because keep in mind, even the recent texts are recent in terms of the age of that particular thing in our hand, but they have a pedigree that goes right back to the original. So somebody before them We don't have those earlier copies along that particular line, but somebody was writing this from the original. And so it could be that the more ancient text actually has the mistake and the more recent one doesn't. And, sometimes you make a judgment call too. And so it's not always an exact science. But we're really talking about very, very minor distinctions. Even this huge passage nothing's at stake with this, theologically. And even in the long ending of Mark, some things seem – this is where you get the snake handling and all of that stuff, drinking poison. But a lot of those things – not the snakes in so many words, but things – speaking in tongues and those kinds of things and working miracles that are mentioned. There are mentioned in other passages that aren't in question. So I don't think we really lose anything of substance by losing the long ending of Mark. All we lose is the snake handlers, and the poison drinkers. But that's all right because, I never had much use for them anyway. So I think that the important thing about this kind of analysis is that what textual criticism demonstrates is that we have a 99.9% pure Bible, but it's that 0.1% that scholars find it interesting to fuss over, but it usually doesn't make a big difference.
Yeah, I think I heard you say other 1% has to do with punctuation, which has pretty much no literal effect on meaning of
Well, it wouldn't be punctuation because there wasn't any punctuation in the originals. It would be spelling errors.
Yeah, okay.
And sometimes the spelling errors are obvious, and sometimes the spelling error isn't a misspelled word, it's a different word.
Yeah.
That is, you make a mistake in spelling and spell a different word. It's like the ones that don't get picked up in your spell checker but are wrong. Mm-hmm. That sometimes that's what happens, and it changes the meaning. And then the question is, wait a minute, did he mean this, or did he, if you just change one letter just a little bit, it means it also makes sense, with this other change in spelling. So then it's kind of curious. Who knows? And people fight about that. John 6, or rather Hebrews 6, is an example of a passage. Not that it's a textual issue there so much as a vagueness in the passage where it talks about those who once drink of the Holy Spirit and blah, 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 and all those things and have then fallen away. It's impossible to renew them again to repentance or whatever. That's one of those passages that's notoriously difficult even to translate. It's hard to figure out what's going on there. And so, in those times we hopefully don't build our doctrines on that. But anyway, it's kind of fun talking about these, but it's a good thing, fortunately for us, not so with other documents from antiquity, but for us it doesn't make a big difference.
Yeah.
Because the things that are important are really well attested to in the documents. Yeah. All right, Jeremy.
All right, well, thanks a lot, Greg.
Yeah, it's a pleasure talking to you, and I'm glad you're doing your homework on this. This is good. We got a break time, right? Okay, let's go to break. We'll be back with Mark in Tucson and Brad in Louisville. Two calls from Louisville today, right? And more of me here on Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
We are ambassadors for Christ. That's what Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20. An effective ambassador has three essential skills. First, an ambassador must have the basic knowledge necessary for his task. Second, this knowledge must be deployed in a skillful way. There's an element of wisdom, a tactical and artful diplomacy that makes his message persuasive. Third is character. His personal maturity and individual virtue will either make or break his message. Stand to Reason's mission is to help you develop the foundational skills in each one of these areas. In Essential Ambassador Skills, Greg Kokel will train you in all three of these areas to be an effective ambassador for Christ and to represent God's message of grace in a broken world. To order this unique message, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. 800-2-REASON or str.org to order Essential Ambassador Skills by Greg Kokel.
Hi, I'm Greg Kokel. You want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about? Well, Stand to Reason can help you do just that. We train Christians, just like you, to be effective ambassadors for Christ. But we rely on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You'll learn how to deliver a message that's accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a character that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting Stand to Reason Radio. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800-2-REASON or donate securely online at str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON.
Oh, yeah, baby. Like a fool.
Greg Kokel giving you a piece of my mind today, as I do every Sunday, 3, 2, 5, here on Stand to Reason. And just a reminder, hey, that the tempest is fidgeting, as my dad used to say. It's this corny way of saying time flies. Time is wasting on the cruise. That is, if you've been thinking about coming on the cruise, you got to move quickly, because within the next few weeks, we're going to be pretty much closing this out. We're not going to be doing it, but the cruise line takes away the rest of our empty berths, you know. I was at St. Louis, as I mentioned yesterday, and someone told me, hey, my folks are thinking about going on the cruise with you on September 16th through 22nd, and 23rd. And in Canada and New England here in the fall, and they're kind of excited about it. I said, well, you better get them to move quickly here, because we're closing the door before long, in just a few weeks. And she was actually surprised, really, because she's thinking, this is May, that's in September, we got lots of time. No, we don't. These things have to be resolved more early. So if you've been thinking about coming with us on vacation, September 16th through the 23rd. And that's Canada and New England cruise in the fall. We're leaving from Boston, and then we're heading north and going around the Maine and into the Canadian Maritimes and up the river and going to Quebec and then finally to Montreal. And you can find out all about that just by going to our website at str.org. And there you get the skinny on it. And we hope that you like what you see. If you've been thinking about signing up, now's the time to do it. We've got to get those reservations within the next couple of weeks, or you'll be locked out. Last summer, when we went to Alaska, a number of people got squeezed out at the end. We would have loved to have them on board, but we had no more rooms allotted to us. They got taken away because, you know, the time had passed. So please think about that. Love to see you there. The information's on our website at str.org. And I'm going to get to the calls in just a second. I just want to mention that to you, my dear listeners, that I have been vindicated once again in a controversial issue that came up on this show. I actually spoke to it, I think, last week. But I had talked about in the Da Vinci Code, and I wrote about this in Solid Ground, and we got a lot of emails about this. I said, gee, his claim, Dan Brown's claim, that 5 million witches, that's right, 5 million, 5 million witches were burned at the stake over a 300-year period in the like 13th, 14th, 15th centuries or so by the Roman Catholic Church. And as I wrote about it, this is one of those things where you just got to think about it. I call this a kind of a wait a second kind of thing. You know, you read it, and if you think about it, you go, wait a second. That can't be right. And I got my calculator out, and I said, that's 45 women a day, every day of the week, every week of the year for 300 years. That's pretty implausible, I think, is the point I made in the book. And people were saying, hey, that's believable. They can do that. That's only 45 a day. That's doable, you know. And so I was getting all these complaints. You know, Kokel had made an error in reasoning, people said. In the movie, watch for it. When this issue comes up, and it does come up in the movie, they don't say 5 million. They say 50,000. Now, why don't they say what Dan Brown said? Because even Ron Howard knows that that's bizarre. That on the face of it, this is bizarre. So they sanitize that little fact. As it turns out, that's even too many. The most liberal speculations, guesses, whatever, the number of witches burned during that time was 30,000. That's nothing to laugh at, really, but it's not 5 million. It's not what would amounted to 40% of the adult female population at that time. See, now I've been vindicated, because even those guys figured this is too outlandish. We've got to tone this down. Let's go to Tucson. Mark, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hi, Greg.
Hello, sir.
You mentioned Dr. Meyer. I actually got to listen to him talk yesterday.
Dr. Paul Meyer.
Yeah.
Yeah, good. Where was that at?
In Tucson.
Oh, on this issue?
Yes. Well, on the Vinci Code, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He's a riot, isn't he?
Yeah, he is.
What a ball of energy. And the guy's, I think he's about 72 or 70. He's 77? Melinda just gave me the numbers there. 77. Or though, 76, 77. Boy, I hope I'm that healthy when I'm 77.
He did great. He went for 6 hours and then 2 hours today. And
oh, man. Well, good. Lucky you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
Well, I've enjoyed your new tactics.
Good. Is that the CD mentoring tapes, or is that the? Are you talking about the DVD plug and play training?
Both. I've had the tapes for quite a while.
Uh-huh.
Now I have the DVD.
Oh, good, great.
But
you've already seen the DVD.
Yes.
Okay, let me ask you a question. Personal question. Does that like blue shirt I was wearing really freak you out? Did it annoy the heck out of you?
No, I guess I never really noticed.
Oh, that. I'm so glad to hear that. I was really worried about that. Okay, great.
It does bring up a question as I'm, you know, getting ready to teach it. One of the issues that often comes up, I'm getting to where I really don't like testimonies very much when sharing your faith. I think they have a place, and I don't want to discourage people from using them.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's an over-reliance on them, and I think, you know, in a pluralistic society, I'm not sure what people really hear,
mm-hmm.
you know, when you give a testimony.
Yeah.
And, you know, when the only sin seems to be intolerance, you kind of seem to undo your testimony sometimes just if you take a stand on anything. And I was just wondering what you think.
In other words, you end up, if in your testimony you start talking about the gospel as it really is, then your testimony turns out to be an example of intolerance. Is that what you mean?
Exactly. Unless you deal with those issues up front. And so I'm just wondering what you...
Okay, let me give you a quick answer. I have mixed feelings about testimonies. I always have. I think they're fine, but they have not limitations, but downside. What's the word I'm looking for? They have their problems or whatever. And that is, I think they're fine because on the one hand, you're bearing witness to what God has done in your life. And by the way, the word martyr, I think the heart of what that word means is to be a witness. Now, the people we call martyrs now were a powerful witness in that they were willing to give their lives and suffer. But I think it's important for us to witness with our lives and with our life story. I also think that and we see this, by the way, the Apostle Paul gives his testimony twice, at least twice in the book of Acts, maybe three times. But so we see that. We see you know, things like in the Psalms, you know, I will declare the glories of God and what God's done in my life and those kinds of things. The psalmist is expressing this. We see Jesus at sometimes, although there are times when he tells people to be quiet, don't say anything, and I think he had a reason for that under those circumstances. Other times it's to declare the excellencies of God. The people went out and told what God had done in their life. And I think this is powerful, and I think that it does make a difference for people. And there are many people probably can reflect on how someone else's testimony has made a difference in their own life. And so, okay, that's on the plus side. The other plus thing is that people like stories, and the postmoderns resonate with narrative, which is story, and they also resonate with authenticity. That is a real life genuinely impacted by Christ, as opposed to a religious thing where you're going through the motions. So when you give a testimony, you're giving a narrative, a story, but you're talking about how Christ has actually worked in your life. And this does, I think, resonate powerfully with a postmodern community. Now, the liabilities, and that's the word I was looking for a few moments ago. Here's the liabilities. The liability is a testimony doesn't make something true. And another way of putting this is a lot of people have testimonies. You know, Mormons have testimonies.
Right, I guess that's where I was going with it.
Yeah, Jehovah's Witnesses have testimonies. Well, maybe they don't have much of a testimony, but that's a pretty dry, dull religion. But I mean, other people have religious experiences, you know. And so in my view, there's got to be something in addition to testimonies that grounds the testimony. And even in Paul's case, when he gave his testimony, he said, I saw Jesus on the road to Damascus. He changed my life because he died at Calvary and raised from the dead 3 days later. So he was willing to ground his personal testimony that is subjective in something that was objective. Because it's easy to be misled. I talked about this a couple months ago. And I talked about how when you read the Bible, why do I believe the Bible is inspired? I believe it's inspired because I think the Holy Spirit has really convicted my heart of that fact. Well, what makes me different from the Mormons? Well, because I've got evidence that I'm not just wishing on a star, you know, and I think the Mormons are. In my case, I can go beyond my, in a sense, emotional testimony, personal testimony about God telling me that, and I can and I wouldn't put it in those terms, but it's just a work of the Holy Spirit, I think, when people believe in the Bible. It's something God does in their heart. But I think there is a substantiation we can go to. And so I think probably the best combination, Mark, is a combination of the two. And unfortunately, a lot of Christians only have their testimony. And that's it. That's the end of the show, you know. And so now they're on par with the LDS or somebody else who's had a dramatic religious experience. And it is easy in a postmodern pluralistic culture to simply say, well, that's nice. I'm glad you found something. Good for you.
Right.
Rather than being touched and say, that's really the truth. So those are some of the liabilities of it. I think if your people are well acquainted with the liabilities and do what they can to minimize the negative impact, I think their testimonies still could be very good. I would never discourage anybody from giving a testimony of what Christ has done in their life.
I don't want to do that either.
And sometimes that's all they have. You know, if you're a brand new Christian, you don't know all the stuff that you know, Mark, or that I or some of the others at Stand to Reason know. But you do know what happened to you. And so that gives every Christian something to say to advance the gospel wherever they're at with other people. But that's just a place to start. That's the first baby steps, and we want to go beyond that, I think, is our point. Sound right?
All right.
Okay, Mark, I appreciate the call.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. And back to, let me find the button, back to Louisville and Brad. Brad, you're really in Louisville?
I am. Must be a main hub of...
Yeah, it's just, you must have all kinds of Santa Reason people there. We had two calls in one day. Great.
I really appreciate your ministry.
Thanks a lot, Brad.
This past week, I really had my first opportunity to use what I recently learned from the training materials.
Mm-hmm.
I had a really enjoyable conversation with a lady, but it was clear early on that she was just all over the board with what she believed.
Right.
There was one thing that was very clear to me, and she was really into relativism.
Uh-huh.
So as we talked, basically at one point she said, you know, there's really no truth, to which I then asked, well, is that true?
Mm-hmm.
I thought, hey, she just walked right into it. However, she was pretty quick.
Uh-huh.
And she quickly changed her tune and said, well, we really can't know for sure, which kind of threw me off, because I'd expected her to just go right along with it. So here's my question.
Mm-hmm.
I really thought through afterwards what I could have done better or how I could have really handled that. So what would you have done? What would have been a more appropriate comeback for mm-hmm. me? When she just kind of changed her tune.
Let me just make an observation, Brad, and tipping my hat to you, and it's a learning point for other people. And this is also in the tactics material. But have you gone through the tactics material?
I have.
Okay, so you know one of the ways. Well, you do it because you know it because you're doing it. Now, one of the ways to improve in your tactics, especially the Columbo tactic, is to reflect back on the experiences you have when the pressure's off.
Yeah.
And figure out, okay, what could I have done better this time, next time when it comes up? And then if you think about it and role play a little bit, then you're there, and that's just what you're asking. So when we're in the middle of these things, it's not always tidy, as you know. I mean, sometimes we will get a little bit of – make a little progress, and then all of a sudden we're hit with something, and it's whatever. Oh, see you later, you know. Gee, I botched that one. Well, no, you didn't. You went as far as you could go, and then you ran into your own limitations, and you'll do better next time kind of thing. And so this is an encouragement for people not to get discouraged, because you're not the only one to run into those things. Guess what? So do I.
Okay.
You know, it's not always tidy for me either, and when I run into those kinds of things, and then I'm talking with other friends like you're doing with me now to figure out what I could have done. Here's the first thing that came to my mind. You responded well when she said, well, there's no truth. And you said, well, is that statement true? And she and you know, I like the way you put it to me, because some people say, well, is that true? You know, it's almost like accusative and glibly.
Right.
And I think that's not the right attitude. But when you say, well, wait, is that statement true? I think it's a lot nicer the way you said that. But what did she do? She says, well, you can't really know for sure. And this is what she's done. What she did is she didn't answer your question.
Okay.
And she changed the subject somewhat. And this is where, I mean, I wrote this down, and I hope I think of this next time this issue comes up when they do that. You say, okay, well, now that is that an answer to my question, or I'm – which is it?
Okay.
First you said you can't know anything for sure. There is no truth. And then you said you can't know anything for sure. I really want to understand you. Those are really two different things. Are you changing your idea now? Or are you saying you can't? Oh, maybe you can know some true things, but you just can't know them for sure. Do you see the point that I'm making there?
Yeah, just kind of hold her feet to the fire a little bit more.
Exactly. It's almost like she wouldn't answer your statement, but she modified hers a little bit. So it wasn't quite as vulnerable, but then that looks like she changed her mind, and so you want to draw attention to it. Okay. Oh, did you just change your mind? So there is – I just want to get clear. Maybe I misunderstood, but you're saying there is truth, but maybe it's hard for us to know what it is. Is that what you mean?
Okay.
Oh, well, now that's progress. Because now you could see if she says, well, you can't know anything for sure, and then you could ask her the same kind of question. Are you sure about that, or are you uncertain about it?
Okay.
Is it possible that you could know some things with more certainty? You know, and so you're applying the same thing there. And then if she's skeptical, I look at if somebody says there is no truth, they're really saying that there are no facts. And so that might be one way to put it. Are you saying that there's no knowledge? There's nothing you could say is a fact? Because if it's a fact, then it's true. It's a truth, if you will. I mean, so when you put it in a little different terms, then maybe they realize what they're talking about. And they say, well, I guess there are truths and facts. Okay, great. Well, now we got progress here.
Okay.
Well, you can't know anything for sure. And I'm hurrying because we're about out of time here. But we can't know anything for sure.
Okay.
Well, is that a fact that you can't know anything for sure? And maybe we can know some things better than others? I don't know. Let me work with it that way. Does that help? I lost him. Okay. Brad, thanks so much for the call. I hope it helps. Stick with us here at Stand to Reason and call me back in a couple weeks and tell me how you did. All right? It's good talking to you. Hour number two just ahead, and we got a lot of callers on board. We'll get to you right here on Stand to Reason. Stay with us. French cow is le mu. The British cow goes mu. I say mu. The Italian cow goes mwah, mwah. Where did you get that? Oh my gosh. That's from my early days in radio. And it wasn't on the air. We were messing around in the studio. I dug that one up. Greg Kokel, hour number two here on Yep, Stand to Reason. Kind of embarrassed to say it now after that opening. 1-800-227-5278. Lines are pretty full up, actually, right now. But there's room in the 714 area code 754-4150. Actually, we do have an 800 line open. And I'll be getting to the calls very shortly. Just a reminder that we have a new Frapper winner. That would be Rob Ward. There we go. Rob Wards from Palmerston North in New Zealand. And so my congratulations to Rob there, the Kiwi. And actually, Rob has started a Christian apologetics organization. And we're pretty thrilled to see that happening. I think we might have had some role in his life in educating him and equipping him. And we're thrilled that he's taken the things he's learned from wherever to his Kiwi compatriots. If you're interested in what they're doing, I've got a website you can check out, christian-apologetics.org, christian-apologetics.org/MCAS/. That would be a forward slash. So it's christian-apologetics.org/MCAS/. I think that has something to do with New Zealand. I'm not sure, but give them a visit. And Rob, we'll be sending out your gift shortly. Just signed it today, in fact. If you don't know what Frapper is, go to our website, and under podcast, you'll find a map there, which is a place where people who have registered because they listen to our show put a pin on the map and identified that they're a listener. We've got 597 people registered now and counting, and every week we draw from that group and send a free gift, often a book. to that person. And we just like you to be a member of our community and to sign up as well. So go to SDR.org there on the homepage and look up the podcast section. You'll see the map. It might take a few seconds to materialize depending on how much bandwidth you have. And then go ahead and register on our Frapper. And who knows, maybe next week we'll be saying your name. Okay, let's go to Felix in Puerto Rico. Felix, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hello, Greg. How are you?
We've never had a call from Puerto Rico. So glad that you're our first.
Oh, thank you very much.
Congratulations.
Program very much.
Thank you. You must be a podcast listener.
Yes, sir.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I was just wondering, you a long time ago gave like three ways to ask concerning the emerging church, three questions we should always ask them about truth, the correspondence theory, and the other one was the cross.
Well, yeah, there's actually four areas that I'm concerned with. One is, what is their understanding of the Truth Knowledge Project? Do they believe in truth, its correspondence, and is there knowledge, and can we know we can know it? Secondly, what is their view of the cross? Well, actually, the second one is, what is their view of the scriptures? The third one is, what is their understanding of the cross? And the fourth one is the Great Commission. And these are the areas that I think where there is compromise in the emerging church, and there isn't always compromise, but where there is, the compromise and confusion is in those four areas. And I did say that if they get the first one wrong, they can't get the next ones right, even if they get them right. Which means that if you don't have the right understanding of how knowledge and truth work, then it turns out even if you affirm classical Christianity, the other three, basically you're just affirming that it's part of your story, not that these things are actual facts of reality.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And I was just wondering with the correspondent theory, okay, how would you answer that the correspondent theory in itself is not self-defeating if they ask you, well, does the correspondence theory of truth correspond to reality?
The answer to that is yes.
In what sense?
Well, I guess what somebody is going to have to do, first of all, there is no self-refutation even in that, and I'll explain to you in a few moments why that's the case. But the burden of proof is not on me in this case. If the person thinks that my point of view is self-refuting, they've got to do more than simply ask the question, is it self-refuting? And then I say no, and they say, prove it's not self-refuting. The burden is not on me to prove that my view is not incoherent. The burden is on the other person to show that it is. If it seems in a straightforward sense that my view makes sense, it's their job to dig out the hidden incoherence, if one exists, and show me where it is. So the burden of proof is on them in this circumstance. However, I will make a defense for this. It can't be self-refuting because it isn't really a claim like that. What the correspondent's understanding of truth is just simply a way of describing what people mean when they use the word truth. So, truth is a word that's used in our language. You know, every language probably has its word for that. So, when people say that something is true, what is it that they mean? If I were to say that it's true that there's a red car in my driveway, what would have to be the case for my statement to be accurate?
There must be a red car.
There's got to be a red car in my driveway. In other words, what we mean when we use the word truth is that our statements fit the way the world is already, or our beliefs or whatever. That's why they call it correspondence. So in other words, my claim fits the world. It corresponds to the world. Now, if it doesn't correspond, then it's not accurate to say my statement is true. In fact, we don't say that. We say it's false. If you say that it is and it is, or if you say that it isn't and it isn't, that's what true means. If you say that it isn't and it is, or if you say that it is and it isn't, then that's false. That was characterization from Aristotle, but I mean, anybody could have said that because that's the common sense garden variety definition of truth. Now, if somebody says, well, does your definition of truth correspond? They're just asking me whether I've got the accurate definition or not. But it's commonsensical. All one has to do is to reflect for a second to realize that in almost every single case when people use the word truth, this is exactly what they mean. Mm-hmm. Paul says, I am telling the truth. I am not lying. If I told you I just won $1 million in the lottery, you'd say, wait a minute. Really? What do you mean by that? You mean, are you telling the what? Truth. That means, is it a fact in actuality? Indeed, you have won that. And if you hadn't, then it's not true. So the strength of the correspondence definition of truth is that it actually does correspond. Mm-hmm. That it is, I call it the garden variety definition of truth, because the word truth can be nuanced to mean other things. It could mean subjective truth. It could mean pragmatic truth. It could mean coherent truth. But that is not what most people mean.
Okay.
When they say it.
So, and there's no problem if they don't believe in the reality of propositions and universals. It wouldn't make a problem between the correspondence understanding between both parties?
Well, they would, you know, I'm passing right now on the possibility that there's something self-refuting about denying universals and believing in the correspondence view of truth. But at least prima facie, on the surface, I think you could say, no, one who doesn't believe in universals actually thinks that the statement, there are no universals, is a true statement in the correspondence sense.
Okay.
Does that make sense to you?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I don't. This is sometimes made more difficult than it actually is. It's you know, when I say truth is correspondence, that's the standard way of using it. I'm not saying anything remarkable. I'm not saying anything out of the ordinary. I'm saying something that's so pedestrian it ought to be boring for people. It's amazing how controversial this notion has become. I'll tell you one of the reasons why, though, in a postmodern world, for me to claim that I have truth in the sense of correspondence, that means that I have reason. I am making a claim that matches up the way the world really is. By the way, I could say something. I could make a true statement, but not know that I've made a true statement. All right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I could say there are five rocks on the surface of Mars, and it could be actually what's there. But I don't know that. So you can have a statement that's true, but you don't know it. All right. But what we're working for is to try to get true statements that we know are true, and therefore we have some reasons to believe it's so. The problem with this discussion with some people is that they don't believe you can get at the world the way it really is. So even if you by accident make a true statement, you know,
mm-hmm.
That is, your statement actually happens to match up the way the world is. There's so many barriers in the way of getting at the world the way it really is that you can never know that your statement is true.
Okay, and so truth in the basic sense, logic is not the only test for truth then, right? Because there are things logically possible but not real.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Okay.
It's a necessary but not always a sufficient test for truth.
Okay. So what would be the sufficient?
Well, it's
logic and correspondence.
Well,
undeniably,
you'd have to. Well, you can't say that. In one sense, you could say correspondence is the sufficient test for truth, but that's just like saying all bachelors are unmarried males.
Mm-hmm.
If you can demonstrate that there is a correspondence between your claim and the way the world is, then you're entitled to call it a true statement. That's probably the simplest way to put it. Now, sometimes you know there's no correspondence because there's a violation of rationality. If I told you I had a square circle in my glove box in my car, you'd say, I don't even have to look. I know there is no such thing. There's an incoherence in the claim itself. If I told you, listen, my mother is younger than I am, you want to meet her? You wouldn't have to waste your time because that's disqualified by rationality, the way we know things are. So those are necessarily false. But however, there's a lot of things that could be possible and could even be plausible that aren't true. And this is where you've got to go further.
Is it possible?
No.
I mean, in the sense that it's meaningful for your example to put it as an example of something that is not meaningful.
No, a square circle is not it's not possible that there can be an object that is a square circle.
As an actual.
Yes, that's the point.
As an example.
Well, I can use the phrase square circle to refer to something that couldn't possibly exist.
Okay.
Sure. I mean, but the thing that exists there is not the square circle. It's my words that describe this non-existent thing.
Okay. In that sense, it's true.
Well, yes, we know there are no square circles.
Okay.
Okay, because the laws of logic disallow that. So logic can be a necessary. Your beliefs have to be not violate any laws of logic. So there's a necessary condition, but that's not sufficient to know whether it's true. You've got to go further than there. All that does is disqualify possibilities. It doesn't qualify them. And this is where you search out and you find the evidence and you figure it out for yourself. You know, you have to find out,
okay,
and through a number of different ways. But the I don't think that. Listen, if you're a Christian, you cannot deny the correspondent's view of truth and still be a Christian. And the reason I say that is Christianity entails affirming certain factual claims. Now, it's not enough to affirm the facts, but it's not sufficient, but it is necessary. You have to not only affirm them, then you have to trust in them. So if you do not believe that Jesus is, in fact, the Savior of mankind and will forgive your sins because of what he did on the cross, then you're not going to trust in a thing that you don't believe is so. You must acknowledge first that that's true, and it's got to be true in the correspondent sense, because fantasies or stories or symbols don't save people. Only a real Jesus who actually died on the cross at Calvary 2,000 years ago can save someone. Now that you've affirmed that fact, and by the way, that's a proposition, once you acknowledge the truth of that fact, then you can act in trust and depend upon him, and that's the next step that brings salvation. But the one is necessary. That's why I mentioned if you don't acknowledge or agree or affirm that there is truth in the correspondent sense and truth can be known, you're totally out of sync with biblical Christianity. In fact, if you deny truth in that sense, you cannot be saved. It's not possible for you to satisfy the conditions that salvation flows from.
Known in an empirical adequacy test is what you mean to finish it off.
Well, right now I'm not talking about an empirical adequacy at all. I'm talking about the nature of truth and what's required from Christianity. Now, whether or not the things we believe are true are indeed true, that's a different step. And so, an empirical assessment would be one way, but you're not going to empirically assess the resurrection because it happened 2,000 years ago. You don't use empiricism to find out whether that happened. You use a historical method to find out whether that happened, and that's a different discussion. Does that help you,
yes,
Felix?
Sir. Yes,
okay.
Sir. Thank you very much for your help.
You're welcome. I appreciate the call from Puerto Rico.
Thank you, Greg.
Okay, bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
We close to the break. We can go with the next caller. Okay, let's 1-800-227-5278. This is Debbie. Debbie, where do you hail from?
Yes, I'm from Costa Mesa.
Costa Mesa, not Costa Rica. Okay, we've had all these exotic locations people have been calling from, but it's good to hear from you from Costa Mesa. Hi.
Yes, I have a problem with the Apostle Paul,
mm-hmm.
and I was wondering, I thought that he was a little bit chauvinistic in some of the things he says, and I'm not sure if that's really true. I'm a single woman,
mm-hmm.
and I believe
Debbie, I think I know you, don't I?
Yes, you do.
It's so nice to hear from you again.
Yes.
Well, that's great.
Yeah.
What would you say, you use the term chauvinistic, I mean, there's a general understanding I have of that word, but specifically, what do you have in mind? And I have to know that before I can answer the question about Paul.
Okay, there's a scripture in 1 Corinthians 11, mm-hmm. 9. It says, "For indeed man was not created for the woman's sake, but woman for the man's sake."
Mm-hmm.
And it says in that chapter, mm-hmm. verse 3, it says, "But I want you to understand that Christ is the head of every man, and the man is the head of a woman,
mm-hmm.
and God is the head of Christ."
Mm-hmm.
And so I just thought, well, it sounds like the woman is to be subservient
mm-hmm.
to the man, and I just have a problem with that.
Okay. Okay, let me try to answer it. In the passage that you cited there, it said that man was the head of woman, and that God was the head of Christ. Okay?
Right.
Now, is Jesus God?
Yes.
Okay, so is there any value difference between God the Father and God the Son? Is there any value difference? If both of them are God, and one is God the Father and one is God the Son, is there any value difference there?
I don't think so. I'm not sure what you mean.
No, I think you're right. There is no difference. If right. they're both God, then they're equally valuable. Right. Now, the reason I'm pointing this out is I want to start with Jesus first, because I think you've, in some ways, you've misunderstood Paul a little bit. But I also think that there's a, you know, there is a little bit of a cultural kind of reaction that we have about what Paul is actually saying. Jesus was submissive to the Father. All right? The Son was in submission to the Father. Okay? Now, this did not mean that the Father was better than the Son, bigger than the Son, more valuable than the Son. In fact, they both had the divine nature. But there was a submissive, loving relationship there. And so there was nothing, if I can put it this way, negative or wrong or untoward about the relationship of the Father to the Son, even though it says that the Father, in a sense, is under the Son. The Son is under the Father. So if we can think of the Father being the head of Christ and that not being a problem,
yeah,
that's the analogy of sorts to the man being the head of the woman, that there is a certain type of a pecking order that's involved there. A role order, but it's not an order of value. In fact, Paul puts women equal with men in terms of value. And in the time of that culture, this was a radical statement. You know, in that culture, women could not even testify in a court of law because their words weren't taken seriously. The Jewish culture then, they wouldn't allow a woman to even speak in a court of law as a testimony. Because they thought women were beneath the men in a value kind of way. Paul says in another passage that in Christ there is neither slave nor free, Jew nor Greek, right. or male or female. We are all one in Christ.
Right.
So Paul is the great egalitarian there, the equalizer. He keeps all human beings equal before the Lord. Now, there are role differences. And there are leadership roles that men have in certain particular circumstances, like in the church and in the home, that are ordained by God, and Paul talks about it. But that isn't to say that those leadership roles make women subservient to men, probably in the way you're thinking of it, and women less valuable than men. That is never in the case in the New Testament. Mm-hmm. Women are, in fact, the place where it says that women are to submit to their husbands, it's in Ephesians 5, it actually talks more about what the husband is supposed to do for the wife. And there they say the husband should live sacrificially towards the wife, just the way Christ sacrificed himself for the church. So I think when we look at the entire way that Paul addressed this issue, and we're careful not to overreact because we kind of have a cultural sensitivity to words like this. When we look at what he actually meant, we realize that he had a pretty neat thing going the way he taught about women given the context of that time.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense to you, Debbie?
Yes, it does. I guess what some of my problem is that I in our society today women are pretty independent mm-hmm. generally, and I'm a fairly independent woman, mm-hmm. but though very committed to Jesus.
Right, I know you are.
And so it just seems like a lot of women would have a problem with this, especially if I was a woman and I wasn't saved and I read some of the teachings of Paul. I think I would have a little bit of a problem.
No, I understand that. And people have raised this as a problem. And part of my comment is we are looking back from the 20th century to the first century, and we are judging the first century by 20th century sensibilities. And some of those sensibilities aren't even right, but they're the way we think. And so we jump when we read something like that. But when you read the entire account, all of what Paul said about women and men, etc., and even in that one passage where we see Jesus is the head of God, and God is the head of Jesus and man is the head of woman, even that comparison gives us reason to believe that he's saying something good about the relationship between men and women, not bad. And when we read the rest of what he said, especially in light of the culture, that Paul is speaking in a very egalitarian way, even though he identifies some role distinctions. Now, some people don't even want role distinctions. And I don't know what to say about that, except for this seems to be God's way, and that's up to him to make those decisions. But I don't think that there's a legitimate concern for abuse from the text here. That I think that Paul is teaching an egalitarian message that is really ennobling for women. So does that help, Deb?
Yes, it does.
Okay, I got to run to break here. I wanted to take a little extra time with you because you're an old friend of Stand to Reasons.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, Debbie. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
I'm Greg Kolkel. More to come. Stay with us.
Stand to Reason has an absolutely unique cruise conference experience for you this fall. Hi, I'm Greg Kolkel, and on September 16th, we'll set sail from Boston with Holland American Cruise Line. We'll enjoy the scenery of the New England coastline, the Canadian Maritimes, the St. Lawrence Seaway, Quebec, and Montreal. In addition to the scenery, you'll enjoy the fellowship of other like-minded Christians and a conference program designed for those who want to represent Christ to a world looking for answers to life's toughest questions. And I'll be joined by some very distinguished guest speakers, Dr. J. Wesley Richards from the Acton Institute, national radio talk show host Kirby Anderson from Probe Ministries, and Kurt Swindoll of Cool Strategies, who will emcee all of our events. Our plan is to stimulate you with challenging presentations, answer your questions in open forum discussions, and enrich you through interaction and fellowship, all against the backdrop of New England and the Canadian Maritimes in the fall. Come join Stand to Reason and our all-star lineup for a memorable spiritual adventure. Space on board is limited, so get the details from 1-800-2-REASON or visit str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON or str.org. I look forward to seeing you on board.
The Apostle Paul knew well the effect on those who engaged in empty chatter as they spread the virus of false knowledge. They went astray. So while entrusting the treasure of truth to his disciple Timothy and encouraging him to entrust it to other faithful men, Paul also exhorted him to guard the treasure. Paul's word guard comes from the activity or office of a watchman whose job it is to protect those who are asleep from harm. It implies a deliberate, conscious act and demands discernment in knowing what it is that has been placed under our care. Guard the treasure was Paul's final message to Timothy before Paul's death. It reflected the heartbeat of his ministry. Stand to Reason has chosen it as our theme this year because it reflects the heartbeat of our ministry. Guard the treasure which has been entrusted to you. To learn more about Stand to Reason and how we are training Christian ambassadors to guard the treasure, visit us at www.str.org. Our website is full of unique and useful training materials to train you to be an effective ambassador for Christ. That's www.str.org.
Greg Kolkel back with you here on Stand to Reason. And 1-800-227-5278 is our number here. And I saw the Da Vinci Code yesterday. I talked a little bit about it last hour. And if you want to call in and tell me what you saw, fine. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it as a movie. And I thought it was largely sanitized from the book in terms of the kinds of things that offend us. Although it still had it was the Da Vinci Code, and it has this story, you know, that it followed. But a lot of the more bizarre claims were dropped out. They even made it clear in the movie that Opus Dei wasn't a murderous group. You know, they don't murder people. And I think Tom Howard saved himself a lawsuit there. But anyway, let's go to Arlington, Tennessee. Will, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hello, Greg.
Hi, we've had two callers from Kentucky today. Now we got Tennessee.
Yeah, it's our turn.
Yeah. You know, if I were to move somewhere else than Los Angeles, which I'm here principally because of Stand to Reason, I think I'd move to Tennessee. I told that to somebody yesterday.
We were just waiting for you.
Okay, what's on your mind, Will?
Well, first, thanks to everyone at STR. Your materials are been very helpful. I've also been listening via MP3 for about 3 years.
Oh, that's great. Well, I thank you for the crowd.
Sure. My question concerns persuasive tactics used by the pro-life movement.
Mm-hmm.
You've written on this before, but maybe my question will take a slightly different tack if you'll give me a minute to set
okay.
Many people within the pro-life movement engage in public protest of abortion, often mm-hmm. at abortion clinic sites.
Right.
One criticism from abortion rights advocates is that while lighting candles in observance of Roe v. Wade or public demonstration on Main Street or at City Hall or marching in D.C. is an acceptable form of protest, Meanwhile, showing up at abortion clinics, sometimes to the point of shouting at the clinic staff and patients, is out of bounds and not valid discourse. And abortion rights advocates say, you know, this confrontational atmosphere that pro-lifers create not only serves to intimidate the patients or potential patients, but also erodes sympathy for the pro-life cause.
Let me ask you a question. Do you think that most pro-lifers who show up at abortion clinics for a demonstration actually comport themselves that way?
I don't believe so, but
I don't
have
think so either.
Information on that.
Yeah, I don't think so either. And just another observation, and this is in a sense neither here nor there, but it's just something to keep in mind. Whenever it sounded to me like you cited a pro-abortion side making a criticism of the pro-life side.
Right.
Okay. Well, this is one of those things whatever they tell you to do, do the opposite. And here's what I mean. Why would the pro-choice side be telling us the things that we're doing that is ineffectual? They wouldn't. And sometimes when they tell us, oh, what you're doing is causing a problem for you, you shouldn't be doing that, they're saying it. It's kind of like showing videos of aborted fetuses. Oh, you're really losing your audience now. Why do they say that? Why are they giving
rhetoric.
Pardon me?
It's empty rhetoric on their part.
They're trying
to use inflammatory language, you know, to say that we're being inflammatory.
Yeah, I'm making a different point, though. I'm saying they're advising us how we could be more effective, and they're saying, you know, you could really be a lot more effective if you didn't show those nasty pictures.
Because they're trying to mislead us.
Well, yes. I suspect they're saying that because those nasty pictures are so effective, they don't want us to use them because it hurts them, not us. And so it's just something that whenever they give recommendations about how we can do our job better, it's good to take that with a grain of salt. That's all I'm saying here. Okay, but I have my own response to your question.
Well, my actual question is, given those objections, are such demonstrations at abortion clinics per se rightfully within the realm of acceptable tactics that the pro-life side should employ? And in deciding so, can we draw, say, meaningful parallels with other endeavors against social ills, such as, you know, temperance movement or abolition or civil rights?
Well, I think they're legitimate tactics. Okay, that means there's nothing about them that's, I think, wrong on their face. Now, a legitimate tactic still may not be a very productive one, and I think this is part of one of the questions we have to ask. I've had concern about life chains. Because you get a lot of manpower showing a lot of support for the pro-life cause, and I'm asking, how much bang do you get for your manpower buck and those kinds of things? And I don't think very much.
Versus funding.
Well, if you look at if let's say you got 1,000 people that show up for one of those things, all right, and they spend say 5 hours. You know, going to and from and going to the rallies and all that other stuff. 1,000, that's 5,000 man hours at $10 an hour. That's $50,000 worth of time that's spent. I'd rather have those guys work for 5 hours extra, take their money, and give the $50,000 to the abortion clinic. I bet you that would have – I'm sorry, the pro-life clinic.
Right.
Oops. See, it's like, you know, I need the vacation. All right. And I think they'd get more bang for their buck then. Now, it doesn't have the kind of emotional payoff for the pro-lifers. They can say, yeah, we're out there. We're really doing something. But I'm asking the question, what do they accomplish? What do they actually accomplish from doing that? Now, I think shows of solidarity and marches in certain circumstances – get the attention of some people, and especially politicians, if the numbers are large enough. It's in Washington, and the news covers the local news covers it. But you know, even there, you're not sure that it is having the impact that's proportionate to the effort that goes out. But I don't think that's the case with basic life chains. You know, for every person that might say, oh, isn't that cute or sweet or rah-rah for our side as they drive by, a bunch of other people are saying, look at those morons.
Right.
I can't believe it. They're clogging up the traffic and doing this and that, and why, they're so dad-blasted annoying. I wish they'd keep their hands off my vagina kind of thing. You know, maybe we're doing more harm than good. What's going to make the bigger difference, and this is what I've argued with life change, is I'd rather see people that have some skills or even taught some skills, and even if they don't have any skills, to try to engage people who are going to have an abortion in conversation. You know, a lot of people that are going to – and I know there's some legal restrictions. You know, they got the bubble and all of that stuff. But I would rather not see a big demonstration in front of a clinic, and I would rather see individuals in a gracious, loving way sharing – with women who are seeking to have an abortion and trying to persuade them otherwise. And I know the other side, pardon me, the other side calls this intimidation and lions and tigers and bears, all these awful things. But look, it's just, it's a persuasive enterprise. I mean, we're trying to talk to people. We're doing our best to get, and if they don't want to talk, they can keep walking. But you know what? There's a lot of women that want to talk. And you know why? Because they're walking slowly towards that clinic because they know they're doing something wrong. And they're looking for a way out. And their boyfriend is pushing them, or their dad is pushing them, or their stepdad, read between the lines, is pushing them on this issue. And they don't want to have the abortion, but other people are making the choice for them. So much for a women's choice. And I think that if we did more of that, we'd see better bang for our buck, to put it simply.
Sure.
So there you have it. Okay, Will?
Thank you.
You're welcome. I appreciate the call from Arlington, Tennessee. Are we looking at a break here? Or we've already done that, right? Now we got – okay, great. Let's go 1-800-227-5278. Lines open there and the 714 area code 754-4150. We're just going to keep going through callers here to the end of the show. So call in and I'll do my best to get to you. Carl, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hello, Greg.
How are you, sir?
About the Da Vinci Code, there's a lot of material, and I have a lot of it, you know, that rebuts the movie and the book and so on. But I'm looking for some tactical pointers. You know, say you're talking to the waitress at the restaurant or somebody on the bus or something. You know, what can you give me something along that line?
Okay, I can. And this question was asked me last night after the lecture, where I spent an hour and 15 minutes just pouring out all this detail. Basically, it's the same detail you can find in the double issue of Solid Ground that just went out. And if anybody doesn't have that, go right now to our website, str.org, right there on the homepage. Tap the Mona Lisa, and you'll get a PDF file of the article. And you can download that, print it out, and make copies and send it to friends and whatever. Just use the heck out of that, because that's what it's there for. One of the things I was asked was this: what about the tactical moves? Now, what do you think my favorite tactic is, Carl?
The Columbo.
There you go. So what I'm going to be looking for is questions that I can be asking. So if I got a waitress there, maybe the first question I'm going to ask her is, did you read the book? Did you go to the movie? And what do you think my second question is if she said yes to either of those?
What was your impression of or something like that?
Great. Did you like it? Yes, no, maybe so. If you liked it, why did you like it? There's another question. That's easy. So there's three questions right there. Who's doing most of the talking right now, by the way?
The other person.
Yeah, the other person. The burden's on them. The pressure's on them. If there's any pressure, not really. It's a conversation. But there's none on you. And then the big question, actually the next two are bigger. The next question I'd ask is, well, what did you think of the ideas? Okay. In other words, the thesis, Mary Magdalene, the Bible deal, all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. What'd you think about that? Now, if they say, it was a bunch of nonsense, then I say, that's what I thought too. Good. That's pretty much, the end of that. If they say, I thought it was really intriguing. I thought it was true. I'm convinced. Then I have my final question, and it's a one-word question. What do you think that question might be?
Why?
Why?
Yeah.
Why? Why are you convinced? I mentioned to the group last night that a lot of people just read the book, and because Dan Brown says so, they believe it. Isn't that the same objection they raised to us? You read a book, and you believe it just because it says so.
Oh.
That's really stupid, right? The Bible, in this case. And, of course, that's not the reason that I believe it, but that's what they think. And they think that's dumb, but they're the gullible ones who read Dan Brown and think, wow, just because they read it in a fictitious book, they believe it. Now, it seems to me they ought to have some good reasons why Dan Brown's ideas, or the backstory in particular, not that they believe there is a Sir Teabing or a Sophie Neveu or whatever, but the backstory about the documents and Mary Magdalene and the Council of Nicaea, they must have a reason other than Dan Brown says so. Because I'm going to ask them, and this was kind of funny last night, it's like, wow, they read a fiction book and they believe it, but they better not pick up the Chronicles of Narnia, for goodness sake. They'll be looking for the wardrobe. They'll be trying to book a trip to Mordor if they read The Lord of the Rings, just because it's in a book. Doesn't mean it's true. Now, of course, they'd say, well, that's fantasy, obviously fantasy, but this is different. Yeah, this is fiction. It's not fantasy fiction. It's just plain old fiction, but it's still fiction. But Dan Brown says it's true.
Mm-hmm.
Where does he say that? Well, in the beginning. Yeah, he does say that. Now, how do you know he's telling the truth there? You know, sometimes people, writers put that in books, that kind of stuff, as part of the fiction. Do you remember that movie, the Blair Witch Project? Remember that movie?
I never saw it. Ever.
You never saw that? That was one of the scariest movies I ever saw in my life. But the way they did it was, they made it look like somebody went into the woods and got lost and disappeared, but their camera, their movie camera, their film camera, they were making a film of something, that was saved, and so they watched the film, and they realized what this terrible thing happened to these people. So, but that was all a fiction, but it was put forward, at least in the initial stages, as fact, and that was part of the power of this thing. In fact, I woke up last night in a strange house because I was in St. Louis, and it was a pitch black, and I just had some nightmares, and I woke up thinking about the Blair Witch Project, which didn't help me get back to sleep, by the way. But anyway, it's just there's some things to think about. Will that help?
Yes, thanks.
All right, Carl, I got to run to break, and we'll get to some more callers here right after this. I'm Greg Kokel. It's Stand to Reason.
We are ambassadors for Christ. That's what Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20. An effective ambassador has three essential skills. First, an ambassador must have the basic knowledge necessary for his task. Second, this knowledge must be deployed in a skillful way. There's an element of wisdom, a tactical and artful diplomacy that makes his message persuasive. Third is character. His personal maturity and individual virtue will either make or break his message. Stand to Reason's mission is to help you develop the foundational skills in each one of these areas. In Essential Ambassador Skills, Greg Kokel will train you in all three of these areas to be an effective ambassador for Christ and to represent God's message of grace in a broken world. To order this unique message, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. 800-2-REASON or str.org to order Essential Ambassador Skills by Greg Kokel.
Hi, I'm Greg Kokel. You want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about? Well, Stand to Reason can help you do just that. We train Christians, just like you, to be effective ambassadors for Christ. But we rely on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You'll learn how to deliver a message that's accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a character that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting Stand to Reason Radio. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800, the number 2 and the word reason, or donate securely online at str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON. All right, final segment, ladies and gentlemen, right here on Stand to Reason. Clear Thinking Christianity, that's what we have here. I think Christianity is worth thinking about. We try to demonstrate that every single week on Stand to Reason. Sundays 3 to 5, if you're listening through podcast, you can call us during our live show. And we do stream live if you want to listen that way. You can go to the internet to our flag station's website, and that would be www.kbrt740.com. That's kbrt740.com. You can listen live to this show, and then, of course, you call in during the show, and we'd be glad to take you. We've had calls from all over the country, one out of the country here so far today. Now we've got, by the way, I was just talking with the enforcer about the Blair Witch Project. You want to see a creepy movie, you watch that. But you got to pay attention because the creepiest scene is the very last scene. Unless you've been listening, you won't know what's going on. You won't get the significance of it. But if you've been listening and you know the significance of it, I'm telling you, man, that made my hair stand up. And it wasn't, it wasn't nothing gory. There's no gore in this movie. It's the power of suggestion. It's totally creepy. So, anyway, having said that, let's go to Brad and Chico. Brad, Greg Kokel, hi.
Hey, hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay, thank you. Just a little creeped out here thinking of that creepy movie. But
I know, I watched it a long time ago with my it was my fiance, and yeah, I don't want to remember it too much.
Well, for a long time there, my wife and I, before we had a baby, we had this routine. We'd go to bed at night, and we'd close the door and lock it and say, Blair Witch, stay out. You know, it's like, wah. Okay, go ahead, Brad. Sorry.
Okay, well, I have been, in the last 2 years, just kind of growing in the sense of apologetics and learning why I believe what I believe. Mm-hmm. And it's been very important to me. And I graduated, got my credential a couple months ago, and I'm going to be going into the public school system.
Mm-hmm.
I've been reading Total Truth by Nancy Piercy.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
That's great.
I'm grappling with a lot of that because I've always been that way in the sense of I've always felt like once you're a disciple, you need to infiltrate every single facet of your being.
Mm-hmm.
And my thing in the public school system, it's very complicated because I don't want to compromise my witness, but as you know, most of the public school system is entrenched in, you know, scientific naturalism.
Yeah, right.
And so you have, what is the line? Because with me, I know that obviously a Christian worldview would mean that I need to be competent as under the Lord, make sure I have integrity and credibility, mm-hmm. and I also need to treat the students with honor and dignity and respect.
That's right. Good for you.
Them. You know,
and you have to show respect for your leadership that's over you, too. I mean, you have to, in a sense, play within the rules unless doing so requires that you compromise morality in some critical point, which probably is not what you're facing.
Right. Not, of course, definitely not yet. And especially since I just got my credentials, so I'll be on the low end. But I guess that's where is the line? I mean, as far as is that where it is? I mean,
but I mean, generally the problem in an academic situation like that is not that you're being asked to do something that you know is wrong. You are being restricted in certain liberties to communicate what you know is right. All right. Now, just a couple of observations. I never really thought about this before, this thing I'm going to tell you right now, but it's something to keep in mind. That you're restricted in doing everything that you know that could be something right for you to do, okay, is true in every job you have. That is, if you're giving your attention to your work because you're being paid of it, there are other things that you're not able to speak about or do. So if you're talking about Jesus, that's a good thing because in the sense that maybe the gospel is being communicated, but it's a bad sense in the sense that you're being paid for something, you're doing something you're not being paid to do. You're not doing your job, and maybe you shouldn't be witnessing and doing your work if the two are not compatible. And that's the more honorable thing in those circumstances. So the point that I'm making here, first off, is it's always going to be a trade-off. There are always going to be times, any job you have, where you can't do everything you want to do, even when some of those things you want to do are good things.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think the problem, the big problem is they don't let me talk the way I want to talk about Jesus, because that's true everywhere, and I don't think God expects you to violate that kind of thing. Jesus, one thing about Jesus that I think is odd is he didn't take what seems to be all kinds of great opportunities to tell the truth really clearly.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like he stops short bunches of time, or there are times when he doesn't say anything.
Mm-hmm.
And he just says something cryptic, or he heals somebody and said, okay, no, don't tell anybody that I did this. So I don't see in the model of Jesus, just this blab, 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 blab. We also always have to be constantly talking. Instead, he chose his fights, if you will. He chose his place and his time and the way that he was able to do it. Even when his brother said, go up to Jerusalem. He said, no, I'm not going to go up. Your time's always opportune. I plan my work here. I don't just take any old occasion to be a big shot kind of response. So I think when you're in a difficult situation, no question, being a teacher in this environment. So the question is, how can you make the best use of that circumstance? And I don't think it means finding clever ways to violate the rules and not get caught or something like that. But I think there are two thoughts that I have. One of them is you may have a lot more liberty than you think you have. And there is a publication, and Melinda, you got to remind me to find this publication. I got it in my bookshelf somewhere. That is a publication. I think it's for the state of California, or maybe it's for the. Is the education's under the state, not under the federal, right? Or a little bit of both. I don't know. But anyway, there's a statement. It's a booklet that's printed, and it's affirmed and approved by every liberal group under the sun. And it was during the Clinton administration, that tells you what freedoms and liberties you have and where the legal lines are to be drawn. And when I read that, I was stunned at how liberal it was. I mean liberal in the classic sense, not in the politically left sense.
Mm-hmm.
That is, what they outlined there as appropriate liberties for teachers was much more extensive than I had ever imagined it would be. So I would say first thing is to get a hold of that thing. And if we can find it, I can find it in my own stacks. You know, I'll bring it up sometime in the future and we'll blog on it or something. But you can get this. It's a government booklet, you know. And then you'll have it there, black and white, chapter and verse, the legal liberty you have. Okay, now, over and above that, I think it's possible to work within the system and make an impact in less, less obvious kinds of ways. I don't know why there'd be any problem. Oh, let me back up for a minute. Have you been following my critique of the Da Vinci Code?
Yes.
Okay, my critique is not theological. Mm-hmm. It's historical. There is no reason why, in the context of your educational responsibilities, assuming that such a discussion would be germane to them broadly, that you couldn't have the same discussion I had about the Da Vinci Code that I had, the material in our parallel ground, because there's nothing theological in there. I am not promoting Christianity. I am trying to make sure that people get the history right. That's all.
Right.
Now, maybe people say, well, you have this motive. Well, you don't know what motives I have, and you can't fault me for my motives. The motives aren't on the table. What's on the table is my actions. If my actions are appropriate actions given the educational purposes of this school, and I'm talking about what is history and how can we know what historically took place, what happened at the Council of Nicaea? What is the situation with the early documents of the Christian religion? You can talk about those as a disinterested party, arguably, and still come to the same conclusions I came to. So what I'm saying is it may be that you can, and I'm sure that what I just described is legal, but there's other things that you can do that would in effect undermine the impact of a totally secular education without violating the rules. I don't know why you cannot go after materialism, naturalism as a philosophy. Because if materialism is true, there is no soul. If materialism is true, there are no virtues. There are no moral rights and wrongs because these things are not material. Okay, now when we tell kids in class it's wrong to cheat in a test, you ought to tolerate other people. We are making statements that are totally inconsistent with materialism or naturalism or even methodological naturalism, for goodness sake. So it's fair, it seems to me, to say, you know, well, obviously naturalism in that sense is false. Because if it weren't false, if it weren't false, it were true, then we couldn't be in a coherent way making these challenges to you as students. Like you ought to study and be the best you can be. What do you mean you ought? Well, a mind is a wonderful thing. What is? Don't waste it. What's a wonderful thing? What is that? Are you emoting, teacher? Are you telling me something that's metaphysically true about the value of a human mind? If you're saying the latter, then materialism is dead. It's false. So I'm just kind of role playing a little bit. Some of the things that I think you can do. And the point here is you can advance, you can offer challenges to materialism, for example. You can offer challenges to materialism by championing the virtues that the educational system champions, which virtues are inconsistent with materialism. So you can say, I'm not arguing for Christianity, I'm arguing for what you guys say we ought to be doing, being kind to one another, tolerant. Human beings are valuable. What is that? Now, what you're also doing, though, is you are undermining a point of view that is hostile to the Christian worldview. So you're getting, you know, a lot of bang for your buck. You're killing two birds with one stone. And this is what I would encourage you to be looking for. Look for the opportunities to build up your students in the ways that would strengthen them that's consistent with the educational enterprise that you're involved in, but also turns out to help our side if they ever get to apply it that way. So you're going to, you know, this postmodern idea that there is no truth, you can do anything you want to undermine that, because that works against the educational enterprise. You know, if people are making that claim, sure there is. If there isn't, then why are we in school? you see, and to get students to think better, to teach them to be better thinkers, get them to ask the questions why, how, what do you mean by that? How did you come to that conclusion? And then after they know what they mean by it and how they came to that conclusion, encouraging them to try to match the two up and see if there's a fit. That is, does the evidence support the beliefs that the people actually have? You teach them those kinds of things. When they start learning to think better, a lot of those secular idols are going to fall of their own weight. Do you follow me?
Yes.
So, I mean, I guess if I were in your position, this is the direction I'd be going. I wouldn't be looking for necessarily the chance to start a Bible study or slip Bible verses to somebody. There are a lot of ways, even within that context, that you can make a really great impact for the kind of thing that's important to us without talking about the thing that's important to us.
Right.
So this is kind of pre-evangelism after a fashion. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And the other point that I just maybe am struggling with as far as there will be times, depending on what grade I teach, that will give views of science and whatnot and in that vein and, like, you know, for obviously evolution or whatever. Is that, I mean, as far as business, in some schools, you have to just because of the case.
Well, I don't know why it wouldn't be possible for you to say, I'm teaching you this curriculum because this is the curriculum. I'm not teaching you because this is what I necessarily believe is true.
Oh, okay.
But this is part of a well-rounded education.
So just giving a qualifier.
Yeah, you know, at the end of the show, how the station says, you know, the views and opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily the views of the establishment or whatever. Well, I don't know why you can't do that in your classroom.
Oh, okay.
Well, somebody might say, well, that you're implicitly suggesting that you don't believe in it and you believe something else. And there's only one other thing, and that's creation. So that's religion in the school. You know, I say, wait a minute. If I don't say this, I'm implicitly saying I do believe in it.
Right.
So why should I not at least have the liberty to distance myself personally from these ideas that I'm being forced to teach?
Right.
I'm teaching them dutifully. So you may have a little bit of, you know, a banging of heads with some people, but this is where I'd stand my ground.
Yeah.
And hang in there stand up to them a little bit in that regard. Okay. Well, you got a lot to think about, Brad.
Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate tactics, by the way.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I appreciate that, and I hope a lot of people are getting a hold of that. Thank you, Brad. It's the brand-new Tactics DVD that you can play. It's plug-and-play whole course. I do all the work. You just serve the coffee and watch the TV. All right? Let's go to San Bernardino. Nope, make that San Fernando. And Debbie, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hi. I was talking to a friend of mine the other day. He had gone to some conference, and they were talking. This person was presenting something about, he called it the merging church.
Uh-huh.
And it was going to be like 60% of the people would be in the middle, and they'd be like all wishy-washy and together. And there'd be like four other groups, evangelicals and charismatics, mainline denominations and Orthodox people, and I was just wondering if you ever heard anything like that. Or
yeah, was he? Are you saying that those are the groups that were represented at the conference,
no,
or he was describing kind of the
that's where the church
spectrum.
Is headed. This person,
yeah.
Thing.
Okay. Well, there is a definable group called the emerging church. Okay. Now I'm using my language very carefully here because some people mix up the term emergent church and emerging church.
Okay.
And the best way to distinguish is emergent church is a proper noun that means it's a capital E. It's the name of a group.
Okay.
The emerging troop in a particular group. The emerging church is a broader movement in Christendom of which the emergent church is just emergent is just a smaller part. Emergent was an organization started by Brian McLaren, Tony Jones, and Doug Padgett.
Mm-hmm.
And so those three started this organization. Now, they have very particular views that I am very concerned with, and I don't have time to go into all the details. But broadly put, the emerging church is any church that is reaching out to an emerging generation,
okay.
A generation that is very skeptical about truth and the like. And there is an attempt that is a good missionary attempt, I think. It's sound in terms of the idea, the methodology is to try to look at, we got these new people that they don't believe like the old people did, and so we've got to, they don't talk the same, they don't listen to the same music, and they got all these other values. We've got to find a way to contextualize our message so that they understand it. That's what a missionary does when he goes to another culture. He learns the language, finds a way to make the message fit in the culture. Now, when I say make it fit, I am talking about the methods not the message.
Mm-hmm.
We don't change the message that is the core of Christianity. We change the way that we go about communicating it. Paul says, you know, I became all things to all men in order that by all means I might win some. And so that's what we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
There is a legitimate attempt to communicate the message in a way that's relevant to the culture. And I think there are a lot of people who are in the emerging church movement that are really working hard to keep the message, the Orthodox message, but are changing the method. However, there are people in the movement that are changing the message too. And those three that I mentioned from emergent, I think, are in those categories. Dan Kimball is one of the guys that's sticking with the Orthodoxy and trying to adjust the method. But these other guys, I think, are tampering with the message, and I'm concerned about that. So it's a mixed bag for the emerging church movement, as far as I'm concerned. Out of time, Debbie. Thank you so much for the call, and I'm on vacation here for the next couple of weeks, friends. Brett Kunkel the next couple of weeks, and a replay next week Dr. Meyer on the Da Vinci Code. And don't forget to go to the website, sdr.org, and check out the cruise. We just got a couple weeks left to sign up, and then the deadline. Go out and give them heaven this week, friends. I'm Greg Kunkel for Stand to Reason. Bye-bye now.